From the heart of Central Florida, you are listening to the most electrifying show in media. A Neighbor's Choice. I'm your host, your neighbor, David Gronowski. So glad to be with you all once again across Central Florida. We come to you live. Happy to be with you as we challenge groupthink. We challenge the toxic tribalism that so much of the media is stuck in. And we provide a new path forward, a new paradigm of news analysis, one that's driven with principles in mind, one that's driven in unity, unity around the sacredness of each and every person, made as they are in the image of God. That's what this program is founded on. That's what this program is all about. And that's how we navigate the news, is the idea that the human person is paramount, and that collectivism, whatever form it takes, always draws us into endless battles, endless scapegoating, endless dehumanizing practices. And we always make exceptions when we feel the need to align ourselves with a tribe because they do some things right, that when they get into a habit of scapegoating somebody else, we say, well, you know, they were right on X, Y, and Z, therefore, you know, I'll give them a pass on this, because if I go with the other tribe, they're a lot worse, they'll tear me up, they'll destroy everything I love, blah, blah, blah. Well, you just can't make exceptions. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And that's a simple, old-fashioned, quaint principle that we keep in mind on this program. So joining me now is someone who's going to help me unpack the ever-growing concern over the Real ID Act. He is a columnist and writer for places like the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, USA Today, Barron's. Jim Bovard, how you doing?
Hey, David. Thanks for having me back on your program. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you've become a regular fixture over the last few months on some of the key news stories that a lot of people are missing. But you recently published a story in FFF, Future Freedom Foundation, which is a great place to learn about these issues surrounding freedom. And the title of your story is "The Real ID Act Ravages Our Liberty." And in the story, you're talking about the national ID cards and the fact that Congress passed the Real ID Act in 2005. You note that at the time, Representative Ron Paul was one of the few opponents that warned what was going to happen with this. And then you relate it to some personal experiences you've had in this trajectory. So let's just dive into this for folks who are not familiar with the Real ID Act and how it infected your life.
Well, the Real ID Act was a law that got rammed through after 9/11. Back when Congress and the Homeland Security Department and the government as a whole was able to seize far much power because people were frightened into submission. Not everybody. There have been a lot of groups and organizations, both on the left and the right, who spoke out about the dangers of Real ID. Ron Paul was in the forefront. The ACLU has been good on this issue. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has been great. But a lot of people recognize that this is a huge step towards a national ID card, to having federal dossiers on people, and it's a power that could be easily abused. What happened here in Maryland was that the government decided that the Motor Vehicle Administration had thought they were complying with the law requirements, but then Homeland Security told the state a couple years ago that know that they have to get more information from each driver. So half a million drivers here are at risk of losing their license. And Maryland blindsided thousands of people, canceling their licenses simply because they did not show up and provide additional data to prove who they were at the MVA offices.
Okay, and so and how did you have this situation occur in your life? You had the run-in.
Poor innocent me. So here I am. I'd heard about this. I didn't pay much attention to it. And then I get a notice, and I was a summons to show up at a certain time to prove my identity to comply with Real ID. And I sort of said, I don't need to do this. But then a friend on Facebook pointed out that, what they're doing is canceling people's licenses on basically this frivolous pretext. So I showed up at the appointed time, and I had my stash of documents, but the MVA clerk quickly found a trouble. My passport, my driver's license, driver's license say that I'm James, whereas the IRS forms that I brought said that I was Jim. So this is a well-known ploy by terrorist groups. Jim, James, pretty damn suspicious. So happily, I was, you know, I had enough documents with me that I found a couple 1099s that also said James. So they decided I wasn't a terrorist and didn't take away my driver's license.
So what has been the most persuasive argument in favor of Real ID that, you know, the public has kind of gone along with?
It's a way to save us from the terrorists, and, you know, it's sort of like a vast extension of the powers of TSA as far as arbitrary power and government incompetence. Part of the problem with this is that you're making these huge databases of personal information, which the motor vehicle bureaucrats have access to, and there have been endless scandals of the government clerks, you know, selling the people's personal information illegally and helping people use that to get fake driver's license themselves. There have been so many cases in Maryland that the U.S. attorney should have set up a branch office at the Motor Vehicle Administration just to bust all the clerks.
Wow. And you mentioned that this would set a precedent where they could create a national database and have a dossier on people. Where's your line of thinking going there?
Right. It's a big step in that direction. But part of the trouble, too, is that some of the same folks who insisted that we have to have all these documents are also now pushing for biometric examinations to compel people to give DNA samples or submit to retina scans. And it was only a few months ago that the Justice Department proposed to start collecting DNA from anyone, including U.S. citizens, who is detained at the U.S. border. That would be, you know, almost a million people a year. And if there's another terrorist attack in this country, I mean, I expect the politicians are going to stampede to say that the government has to dictate biometric identity cards for every citizen. So this train is going in the wrong direction.
Wow. So what can folks do? Is this something that they can be dealt with at the state level? And is there growing momentum to challenge this? Or where does this stand right now?
This is something, there was a great deal of momentum to challenge it from 2005 onwards. It was something that a lot of Republicans in Congress were good on. But after 2017, after Trump's election, it just kind of, you know, the states have pretty much rolled over. There have been other issues, and, you know, there's been other panics the media is looking at. So this has actually gotten very little attention the last couple of years. And because of that, Homeland Security has been able to browbeat the states into submitting to its demands. And one of the ways that they're going to probably do that is insist that if someone doesn't have a real ID-compliant driver's license, that person will be prohibited from flying on an airplane inside the U.S. So this is a travesty of what the Supreme Court has ruled about Americans' constitutional rights to travel, but good luck with that one.
Yeah, and I wonder how this might be tied into this government overreach as it regards the pandemic, you know, trying to get
I mean, there is one snowball after another coming down the hill, and, you know, and I'm sure there's lots of folks trying to find a way to tie them all together for one big happy ending.
Wow. You know, it's just amazing how, you know, you mentioned the conservatives and the Republican Party being good on this until they had power. And that's one of the silver linings if Biden wins, is that a lot of these conservatives will rediscover their liberty roots again. It'd be nice and convenient, right?
Well, I saw some of that in 2009, and I'm old enough, I even saw some of that in 1993. So I have great faith in these folks who are going to become turncoats for freedom.
Yeah, as long as they have no ability to affect change, they'll be glad to tell us all the Thomas Paine quotes they'd like to give us. That'd be great.
Well, yeah, it should work out well for their fundraising.
Yeah. Well, Jim, I always appreciate hearing from you, and I want to stay, on this topic and see what we can do to shine a light on the truth of this matter. But we appreciate you updating us with your great work, as always.
Hey, thanks so much for your kind words, David. I appreciate that.
No problem. We'll be back, folks, with more on A Neighbor's Choice. I'm David Gronowski. Make sure, if you're listening on the radio, save it to this station. This is where you want to get A Neighbor's Choice every day. Or if you're listening on podcast or video stream, share it with your friends. This is a grassroots effort. This is the tip of the spear for a new kind of news program, one that's rooted in human liberty and dignity for all. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to A Neighbor's Choice. I'm David Gronowski, your host. So glad to be with you. The website that we have is aneighborschoice.com. You can go there to learn about our mission and what we're doing here on A Neighbor's Choice as we grow across radio land, across podcasts and video streams. We're going everywhere we can to get the message out, which is that human freedom is what's important. Respect for one another. Treating people as human persons, not as members of some kind of collective that they have to be typecasted as and shamed as and dehumanized. It's never going to work. I don't care what the excuse is. It's never acceptable to do that. America is at its best when we treat human people as persons and we afford them their God-given liberty without taking it away, the right to their life, the right to have medical freedom, the right to have property, their right to have the fruits of their labor, the right to have honest weights and measures with their money. Those are foundational things. Everything else like that is fraud, trying to destroy that. Always trying to make excuses. That's what humans are always doing, always making excuses to dehumanize somebody so that they can be justified in scapegoating them and casting all their sins onto them. That's what humans do. That's what we specialize in doing. We start by trying to find some way to marginalize someone that they're not quite right. They're not quite totally human. They're not quite like you. And then as you do that, you pile on more and more justifications to treat them like a monster, to treat them like a villain, so that you can denigrate them and then create a political society in which you can institutionally denigrate people. We have no place for that. We have to fight for human liberty. That is a thing that transcends all of us and captures the imagination of the human heart. And that's something we have to cherish in this country and fight for it in the way we treat each other and the way we talk about the news. And I got to go to this story because it's something that's troubling to me, and we need to let people know about this. The Daily Mail and many others are reporting that a federal judge's son, age 20, is shot dead in the heart, and her criminal defense attorney husband is critically injured after a gunman disguised as a FedEx driver ambushed their home. This, after 4 days, this happened 4 days after she was assigned a case linked to Jeffrey Epstein, the late Jeffrey Epstein, who was running what appears to be some kind of large international trafficking ring with kids connected and touching all the highest places of commerce and government. And so the federal judge, 4 days after she was assigned to a case involving the bank and associations with Jeffrey Epstein, a man shows up disguised as a FedEx driver. So they open the door thinking it's FedEx, and the son of this judge is shot dead, and the husband is critically injured. Well, now, according to ABC News, the suspect who killed the husband or who killed the son and critically injured the judge's husband, involved with the Epstein connected case, the suspect was just found dead, according to ABC News. It was a so-called self-inflicted gunshot wound. Okay, that's interesting. You know, this is something that has tremendous impact potentially, and the idea that this can happen, this is unacceptable. Okay, you cannot have a society in which law is only going to work for a few, and it's always at the disservice of the masses. We cannot have a society in which a government is allowed to have so much power that it attracts the most monstrous psychopaths who then use that awesome power with no legal restraint, no accountability, no checks and balances, as the founders tried to put in and didn't do a good enough job, apparently, because look how binding the Constitution is. But to have a society in which there's a law unto itself, there is no moral foundation for the law, there is no moral foundation for the reach that government puts involved in our lives, and then to have it attract the most disturbing psychopaths one can imagine, like Epstein and his friends, whoever they are, wherever they are, whatever political affiliation they are, and then for these people in the shadows to think that they can just waltz right in, do terrible things to innocence, do terrible things to the rule of law, do terrible things to the public, and then just kill people at whatever they want, and then have their assassin get killed or whatever. I'm sure it was just, come on, who in the right mind would believe that that guy who's trying to assassinate the judge apparently was in the basement at the time when the husband opened the door and was shot, critically injured, and then the son came down to stop it and was killed. And then the suspect allegedly goes out and there's a self-inflicted gunshot. Okay, yeah. I mean, it's so ridiculous. This is a breaking of the fourth wall moment in our time, this story. Ghislaine Maxwell and Epstein, this whole story is a total breaking of the fourth wall to reveal the ugly, repulsive nature of government power. And I don't understand why this story doesn't make people more repulsed about giving more government power to your central governments. Because if it's that easy to compromise powerful people with these shadowy figures and whatever they were running, then why in the world would you want to maintain such a fragile type of system in terms of its ability to be corrupted? Why would you want to have such a centralized government have so much corrupt power over your life, over what you can eat, how you can drive, what medicines you're allowed to take, what you're forced to take potentially, how you're monitored, you're tracked, your bank accounts, your Patriot Act wiretaps, your surveillance through the NSA, as Edward Snowden revealed. How in the world can you know what you see in front of your eyes with this weird freaks, these Ghislaine Maxwell and Epstein and the people that are dying left and right around this whole story, and know what you know about that and say, yeah, let's just vote to increase government's power? Oh, I'm scared of a virus. I'm sure these geniuses that hang out with Epstein, they'll know how to take care of my immune system. Okay, you gotta be crazy to believe that. You gotta be wild to look at this nonsense and say, yeah, let's just give this whole machine more power. That'll do well. I don't care whether you're left or right or whatever. This centralized, one-size-fits-all law system that we have today is not working. And we have to get over this. We can't keep inflating the bubble of our economy with this government-managed system we have. And we cannot keep inflating the myth that a centralized government so corrupt with these creepy situations occurring all the time, when we're finally starting to see it in a public, mainstream media way, and think that this is something that's sustainable or something acceptable. We should let go of this government power, stop surrendering our liberties, our lives, our privacy, our every liberty we have to a centralized authority that is so corrupt and so easily manipulated by bad, corrupt, evil forces, using public monopoly government as a way to benefit them and hurt others. It's unacceptable. We don't want it, and we have to fight for our liberty. Fight for our liberty. While we still have it, fight for it so that you don't have to surrender to the tyranny of living in the hell of fascism or communism or all these other little technocratic systems people try to create. Back in a moment on A Neighbor's Choice. A Neighbor's Choice returns. I'm David Gronowski, your host. We're live on FM and AM, coming to you now. Also on video live stream on Facebook and YouTube. And if you're listening on our podcast, we enjoy your interactions with us. You can always email me hello@aneighborschoice.com. That's hello@aneighborschoice.com. One of the things that we talk about a lot on this program is the way we treat those who we imprison. As you know, for those who listen to this program a lot, I have a big problem with incarcerating people for nonviolent crimes. I believe that if you're going to put someone in a so-called timeout zone, right, if you're having a jail or a prison, that's a kind of timeout zone. You're going to have to sit out civilized society. And the place you put people that when you put someone in that situation, it should be for a violent crime. They're assaulting someone, they're stealing, trying to take over, burglarize someone's house. Maybe they're selling a little old lady, beachfront property in Nebraska. That's fraud. That's an attempt to steal people's money through trickery, and that should be prosecuted. But if you have no victim on the police report, I believe you shouldn't spend a day in a cage, okay? And I have problems with the way we do prison systems fundamentally at the core, but if we're going to have them, they should be used for fighting situations in which you have violent activity that is proven in the court of law. And unfortunately, we don't have that kind of justice system. We have a justice system that's all about making money. It's all about dehumanizing people. And right now we have a raging pandemic that's sweeping the prison systems in which they don't have the ability to self-isolate. They don't have the ability to get proper nutrition. They don't have the ability to get the proper sunshine they need, and the spacing they need, the sanitation they need. That's a very difficult thing to do in prison. And if you're in there for a nonviolent or maybe a trumped-up charge, and you're facing a pandemic in the worst conditions possible, that is an injustice. And we ought to speak out about it and shine a light on it. And so now I'm joined by someone who's been on the program before, and he's celebrating his freedom. He's someone who is an advocate for many folks in unjust sentences around the country, including nonviolent charges. We have Chad Marks with us. How you doing, Chad?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm doing great, and it's great to have you on the show. We've been following your story for some time, and now you've got your freedom back because you've got early release, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, you haven't stopped at all. You've only increased your efforts to help folks who are still stuck behind bars for unjust sentencing, but I wanted to have you on because I've seen you talking about what's going on in the prisons for folks who shouldn't be in there, and they certainly shouldn't be there when there's a raging pandemic and they don't have the ability to isolate. So can you kind of shed some light into what's going on the ground with your work?
Well, right now I'm in the process of helping some women at the Coleman Federal Prison Camp. The coronavirus has struck down there, and it struck pretty hard. They had a death the other day. There's over 100 female prisoners that have been infected. And a lot of them prisoners are being denied home confinement in light of the CARES Act. And a lot of that's based on this risk assessment tool. And they're using that, and they're saying, well, you know, We're only taking a look at people that are minimum score. So with the minimum score, there's a lot of people in prison that are nonviolent drug offenders, but they don't have a minimum score. They may have had one prior, and because of that one prior, they're not a minimum score. They're a low, so they're not even being looked at. I'm also helping some guys that I actually was in prison with before. We have a guy, Chris Hunter. He's in Petersburg, and he's got underlying health conditions, and he's being denied because he's not a minimum score. And what's going on with the minimum score is this. Most people that are being released under that are people that were white-collar criminals that don't have a record at all. So we're leaving people in prison that are vulnerable to death. Some people got 3, 4, 5-year sentences, and those 5-year sentences are going to turn into death sentences because they can't get out of the prison.
And when you say a prior record, does that include any kind of charge, or has to be a violent record in the past, or how does that minimum score defined?
Well, it could be any kind of previous charge. Let's say I have a woman right now. She had a prior cocaine charge, and I believe it was 3 grams, and that was in, I want to say, 2010. And she's got some asthma problems. She's got high blood pressure. She's kind of in bad condition, and they're telling her that they won't send her home on home confinement because of, and she's only got about 14 months left on her total sentence. And she can't get home confinement because she's not a minimum score. So there's a good possibility that she might end up dead.
Wow.
I experienced this myself when I was at FMC Lexington. I had 33 days left on my sentence, and I met all of the stipulations, but I had a low recidivism rate and not a minimum. And they said, well, we're just doing minimum now. And then the AW would actually come around and pass out the denials, and he was smiling at everyone. This was prior to the COVID-19 pandemic hitting FMC Lexington. And some of them same people he was giving out denials to ended up dying over there. We had 7 deaths, over 300 prisoners infected. I believe it was over 10 staff members as well. So the focus needs to be on this pattern score, because you got people that are getting out of prison in 3, 4, 5 months that may have served 10 years for nonviolent drug offenses, but they can't get out of prison because they don't have a minimum pattern score.
Mm-hmm. So again, let's dive a little deeper into that score so we can learn a little bit more about the transparency behind what that thing's all about and why it's not fair.
Okay. It's the risk assessment tool pattern. It came out after the First Step Act.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, I'm just trying to unpack a little bit more and give folks at home who are just totally, you know, this is new for them and they're trying to understand, why can't they give more, you know, if someone, okay, they did a nonviolent thing like cocaine in their past, but they're being, their behavior is wonderful now and it's a nonviolent charge they're in again, where's the pattern of violence? Where's the pattern of, you know, antisocial behavior that would be, you know, justifying keeping someone in a pandemic?
Well, there really is no justification behind it. It's just a reason to be, and I hate to say it like this, but it's just a reason for them to be nasty. Unfortunately, the BOP, they're just nasty people, a lot of them, and they take joy. Like I said, the AW, the associate warden, would come by and tell people, oh, you're not a minimum score, you're going to stay in prison, and he'd hand you the denial himself with a smile. But once the virus came in, he stopped coming to the units. Then it got serious. I mean, I think even with the risk assessment tool, you have counselors and case managers. It's pretty complicated in order to score people. And the case managers and counselors, a lot of them don't even know how to score people correctly.
Right.
But yet they're denying them for not having that minimum score, despite the fact that they may not even have been scored correctly, which is outrageous.
And I think this is an example of where President Trump needs to step up and show a little bit more assertive leadership, because, you know, the whole nation is roiling right now about the injustices of the criminal justice system. And this is an example in which he could use his clemency power directly to start helping folks out who are in a pandemic and show some real mercy and some real grace and some real compassion for folks who know that the criminal justice system is completely criminally corrupt. And this is an easy way to do it. You don't got to worry for a legislative bill where you got all these different interests trying to get their little thing in there. This is a way that Trump can act unilaterally as a leader and show that he's a leader. He needs to act on this because it's not enough just to do the First Step Act. That's not even the beginning of it. I mean, he needs to show some real compassion here. If he's going to hold a Bible up high, then you need to read the Bible that says go and serve the prisoner in prison, because if you've done that to them, you've done it to Jesus Christ, right?
I agree with that 100%. I'm a believer in Christ myself. I think that he could use his clemency power. It's an enormous power. It's a power filled with compassion and mercy. I think he could use it, and in using it, he could save lives. And the other thing is that I think, you know, a lot of people have a misconception about prisoners and prisoners' families. You know, when I was in prison and he passed the First Step Act, and I spoke about this on your show before, I was a jailhouse lawyer. I was able to save a whole bunch of African-American brothers that were sentenced to one. I got out a month ago. He had a life sentence, Ronnie Lauderdale. He walked out of prison the day after I walked out. But had it not been for that First Step Act, I would have never been able to get him out. Reggie Owens, he had stacked 924C sentences. I was able to get him out. So I think the president, you know, he's done some good things with the First Step Act, but I think he should go a little further now. I mean, he let Roger Stone out. I mean, we're all people. We're all human beings. And there's a lot of people, and we can use Alice Johnson again as an example. President Obama left Alice Johnson in prison. President Trump let her out. But look at who she is as an example, because there's a whole lot of Alice Johnsons in prison. There's a whole lot of Matthew Charleses in prison. And they shouldn't. And these same people, that if they don't get released, what's going to end up happening is some of them are going to die. And the BOP is acting like, oh, well, you know, the COVID-19 stuff, it's clearing up, we're doing great. But if you look at what's going down there in Texas, I think it is at Carswell, and you look at what's going on at the women's camp in Coleman, Florida, we have the same problem that we had in Oakdale, the same problem we had in Lexington, same problem that we had at Elkton, when, you know, one of the prisoners videotaped what was going on. They're putting dead people in tents out on a basketball court. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I understand there has to be some punishment and there has to be some consequences for people's actions. But once the rehabilitation's been done and we see that and there's a pandemic and lives are at stake, I think that the president has to exercise his clemency power. And I think it would help him at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion.
There's a lot of conservatives that want to talk a big game about the founding fathers and keeping with the founding fathers. I think the best example of that was Congressman Ron Paul. When he ran for president, he said he would pardon all nonviolent federal offenders immediately. And, of course, that's too bold for everybody else to measure up to. But if we wanted to get closer to the vision of the founders would have a disgusting thought that we have used the federal power to incarcerate people for things that should be left to the states and cities to deal with and to create this kind of perverse incentive in which these bureaucracies have a monetary incentive to keep people trapped in this never-ending prison pipeline system is totally in keeping with socialism, which conservatives are supposed to be against. So, you know, I'm speaking to an audience that is on talk radio, and I know that we don't want socialism. We don't want government health care. That's what you get in prison. You get government health care. It's garbage. It don't work in the prison. It don't work outside the prison. So let's stand up. You know what I mean? I'm getting tired of conservatives being so quiet. You know, your faith, if you're a Christian, your faith gives you all the social justice you need. You know what I mean? You don't got to go borrow somebody else's ideology about social justice. I've got a comment from Cynthia. Yeah, I've got a comment from Cynthia online. Says even Colombia is letting their people go. So if Colombia is doing it, how about the District of Columbia up there in the swamp? Why don't they show some compassion?
Well, I'll tell you this, because you're talking about the founding fathers, right? And we're a nation that believes in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when we talk about that, we have to also think about the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. And if you ask me, this is a blatant Eighth Amendment violation. If you have people in prison that are subject to death, I mean, we got some women down there in Coleman that are 55, 60 years old, 70 years old. There's an 85-year-old woman, I think it was, that died. I mean, If these women have underlying conditions, and there's a high, and we have 120 infected prisoners at the prison and staff members now, and we're going to leave them in prison and no one's going to step in, that's a violation of the Eighth Amendment. That's cruel and unusual punishment. because we're leaving people in prison that are subject to death. A 5-year sentence could become a death penalty.
Wow. And it's, let he who is without sin cast the first 85-year-old grandmother into a prison with a raging pandemic. Let's sink that in for a moment.
I think it's outrageous.
Chad Marks, we're going to continue in just a moment. We'll continue to learn more with you.
Okay.
I'm so glad that Amy Pova of the Can Do Clemency Foundation put me in touch with you and many others, and we're going to continue to build this network so that every human being life is sacred and that their family gets a measure of dignity and restoration as well. Back in a moment on A Neighbor's Choice. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to A Neighbor's Choice. I'm David Gronowski, your host here. We're live across FM and AM, podcast, live stream, happy to engage people from all over the world even on a march for liberty and human dignity. And, our focus is going to be on those who don't have a voice, and that's folks who are literally trapped in prison for, I believe, immoral laws. Where they have no ability to speak and they can't go see their family and they can't get proper nutrition, which is essential for an immune system. If you're going to fight off a virus, you've got to have a good immune system. You got to get proper sunshine. You got to get proper sleep. You can't be woken up all the time with fluorescent lights and loud noises and stressful situations. Also, stress has a huge impact on the immune system. All those are recipes that you get when you're in prison. They're designed to destroy the immune system. They're a form of torture. Put people in these unsanitary conditions. You put people in a situation where they don't have proper food. You give them socialist medicine. They're not going to get any help from that. And then you give them no sunshine. Well, this is not the land of the free. And America's day of reckoning is coming until we repent of our abuse of our government. Our government has become a law unto itself. And you cannot go quote the founding fathers and then not live up to the vision of liberty. And that's the bottom line about this. God desires mercy, not sacrifice. If we're made in his image, we should desire mercy, not the sacrifice of our neighbors for our own petty grievances. I would submit to folks listening right now that more folks have been hurt and more families have been torn apart by alcohol consumption and the abuse of it than any drug that is used for a prison today. I'm talking cocaine, marijuana, all the drugs. More people have been destroyed by the abuse of alcohol than any of those drugs that we're putting our neighbors in cages for today. And I would say to you that if you look back at something that is even worse than the substances that we're incarcerating folks for now, that when they try to punish the evil of alcohol abuse with incarceration, that was called the Prohibition era of alcohol. What did it do? It created worse forms of alcohol, created moonshine, and it created a violent, sky-high murder rate and violent rate, and it gave a lot of power to the gangs. That's where you get the idea of Baptists and bootleggers. They were working in tandem together, useful idiots using the state power to criminalize alcohol because they were worried about real abuse called alcoholism. But you know what they did? They took a shortcut to heaven that led to hell. And that shortcut was to use the force of law to change something that only can be changed in the heart. They saw people being abused by alcohol. They saw families being torn apart by alcoholism. And they said, we'll take a shortcut to heaven. And that heaven is restoration of families, restoration from addiction. They took a shortcut and said, we'll take the state, we'll take the law, and we'll bludgeon people with force to stop that alcohol. And what did it do? It created the death of thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent people caught up by the power that such a law creates for gangs. And that's what's happening right now. But you know what the problem is? It's even worse because we have a raging pandemic and folks locked in prison for substances which have done less than alcohol to hurt families. They are locked in a prison with a raging disease and they don't have the proper equipment for their body to fend it off and to be safe. Joining me now is Chad Marks, who has been in that situation, and he's now free, and he's using his time on the outside to do what he did on the inside, which is fight for folks left behind by a sick system. So, Chad, what can folks, know about, again, the situation going down in these prisons today? Any other person's story that you can reference here to give us some light, give us some wisdom about what's happening?
Well, the prisons, the whole social distancing thing in prison, that's out the window. They line people up, and in my unit where I was at, we'd have 100 guys lined up within a foot from each other three times a day to pick up meals. They're filthy, dirty. They're not being cleaned. There's soap dispensers ripped off the wall. Sometimes they wouldn't even replenish the soap. So, the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, is telling the public a different story than what's really going on in there. And this all comes back to what we started talking about, this pattern score. Personal stories. I have a personal friend that's in Petersburg. He's at a camp. He's at a federal prison camp, minimum security prison. He was able to leave the low security prison on his own, get on a bus, and go to that prison about a year ago. His name's Christopher Hunter. He went to that prison. He has underlying health conditions. He's subject, if he were to contract the COVID-19, the coronavirus, more than likely he will die because of his underlying conditions. But he's not a minimum pattern score. He's a low pattern score. Yet he was able to leave the prison, get on a bus, and drive to that prison himself. He was alone for about 8 hours out in the community driving there and turned himself into the prison after serving about, he served about 15 years at that point. But yet he can't get out of prison because his recidivism rate is a low and not a minimum. I think it's outrageous.
Enrica says that FCI Loretto now has two positive inmates and one staff member. Paul Manafort made it out, but David Barron and many others are fighting for their lives. This is happening right now, folks. What can people do, Chad? You know more about the law here than I'm aware of. So, what can folks can do? What are their options?
This is what I think they can do, and I'm familiar with David Barron's case too, another guy that Obama reduced his life sentence to 30 years, and he's got a few years left, but it's possible that that 30-year sentence and that clemency grant could mean nothing if he ends up dying over there. But what people can do is they can petition the warden at their prison for compassionate release, base it on the COVID-19 pandemic, base it on their rehabilitation since they've been in prison. They have two extraordinary compelling reasons. Once the warden denies them or the warden doesn't answer them within 30 days, they can go to their sentencing judge and make a compelling argument on an 18 U.S.C. 3582 motion for a reduction in sentence to time served. Some people are going to end up with compassionate judges that understand what's going on, and some aren't. It's going to come down to the judge, and it's going to come down to whether or not you make that compelling argument.
And can anybody do this on behalf of any prisoner, or how does that work?
Well, prisoners can do it themselves. They can write the Federal Defender's Office. I've been helping people. The Freedom Fighters have been helping people. You do have some, lawyers out there that are helping pro bono. I think FAM is helping out, although I think they're overwhelmed. I'll tell you, Amy Pope at the Can Do Clemency organization, she's gone above and beyond to help people out. I'm actually helping a woman down there, Adrienne Miller, and I wouldn't have known about her unless Amy had reached out to me. So people are helping. But, we're overwhelmed, too. There's a lot of people, a lot of people that deserve to get out, and there's not enough people fighting for them. But they can petition the court themselves.
And you're not getting proper food and exercise and sunshine in the area.
When I was in FMC Lexington, we went into a lockdown status on April 1st, and I was released on June 25th. We weren't allowed to go outside for... The last week I was there, we were allowed to go out in the little courtyard and walk around. But before that, we had no fresh air. We were being, and they're still being fed this, bologna and cheese sandwiches every night for dinner with an apple that's usually rotten and two little Kool-Aid packs and a bag of chips. So a 25-cent bag of chips like you get at the corner store. So a lot of guys in there don't have money. A lot of women in there don't have money. So they're struggling. And it's rough eating. I don't know anyone that can eat bologna and cheese for 90 days every night for dinner. It's ridiculous.
And there's no nutrition there. That's a recipe for inflammation, and especially without getting vitamin D and exercise. But Chad, I appreciate what you're doing. Keep up the work. Keep up the fight for liberty. You're welcome back anytime when you need to update us on a particular case. And we're going to keep paying attention to what you're doing. And thanks for what you're doing.
I appreciate you for having me.
We'll talk soon. A Neighbor's Choice is in the books. Look, folks, this is the first hour. We got another hour coming up. But I want you to remember here, when you visit someone in prison, when you put your shoes in their shoes, you're starting to do what Jesus Christ told you to do. We have a country where 70% of us or so say they're Christian. You know what Christian means? It means little Jesus, a little imitator of Jesus. So let's get to work. I'm David Gronowski. Godspeed.